Well, it's like we just talked about with Whitley Strieber talking about how it's all justified because it's making him more evolved.
Yeah.
But it's, wouldn't the gag of the whole thing be if, it's just making us all crippled and weak, but but that we accept it because we think that we're super, you know?
Well, this really is the thesis of Prisoner Infinity, or one of them. I guess it's multiple thesis work, but Kripal was the inspiration for it. I'm sure he's lamenting this, but anyway, and Kripal, I don't know if it's how I first became aware of him, but certainly it was the first book of his I read. Anyway, it was Mutant and Mystics, which is all about superheroes. So, like, Christopher Knowles is also another one who's a pal of Jeffrey Kripal now. Both hang out at Esalen, which is all about developing a human potential movement that Aldous Huxley coined. Both into superheroes. And, you know, I grew up on Marvel superheroes. You did too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Jonathan Leeson, we've talked about this, we've bonded over it. They were so formative to me. I mean, like, some of my most acute memories, and I don't have early memories, so from about 8, 9, 10, I actually recently printed up off the internet covers of those British versions of the Marvel comics that I had as a kid, because just looking at them created such a powerful, visceral feeling in me of this, the wonder and the enchantment that I felt back then, which I now associate with these comic books, which actually were about wonder and enchantment. So these narratives about empowerment through trauma, really, I certainly didn't see them like that back then, obviously, but you're right. I mean, the Hulk is radiation was the main thing with the Marvel heroes, but obviously radiation is intense trauma for the body. It's poison, right? Psychic poison.
Wolverine has his, he's actually like tortured.
Yeah, he's just torn to pieces, really. That's kind of shamanic, actually, like a dismemberment, because then he has special, things put inside his body. That's very shamanic. Rebooting this now for the new generation is the thing. Like Kripal, I mean, it occurred to me recently that Kripal, he looked at Marvel superheroes in correlation with mysticism, shamanism, all of that stuff. And the last chapter, I think, of Mutants and Mystics is about Whitley Strieber. So the first time he wrote about Strieber was in this book. So it's like he was incepted with these narratives about how the human potential is to become a superhero or a mutant through trauma, in brackets. And then he conflated that with his interest in Eastern mysticism and whatnot. And so he's come up with this, it's like he doesn't see, because he's been incepted with these values at such a young age, he can't see, it seems, the ideological indoctrination and the deception that is present in them, because when we're children, of course not. So we have associations with those things. And if we let those, because they're very strong emotional resonance, that really suspends all rational thought. Right? We're not really thinking about what are the values embedded in these narratives, because we're just carried away by the narrative. So it's like it's I'm having a hard time putting this into words, but it's very fundamental to what I was trying to say about social engineering, is that it puts images inside us, and those images shape our internal space and our identities, and then we will create the world and the values and the beliefs and all of it, that represent those images. So it just seems as though that's what I'm exploring in Prisoner of Infinity, is this whole spiritual/scientific, pseudo-scientific, I would say, and pseudo-spiritual value set, which comes down to, yes, you too can be a superhero mutant if only you embrace your trauma. So that, on the one hand, that is now being represented kind of in academia and in the New Age and all these other different areas of adult engagement. And then on the other hand, it's being rebooted with these Marvel movies, which are just huge now. Like, kids now are there as they're into superheroes the way that our generation were, but not through the comic books, but through the movies, right? Which are military industrial products. They totally are, right? They literally are. They have got cooperation from the military and all the rest, all the hardware. So they're completely literally, it's like the next level. Like, you're reading a comic book. Well, A, I don't think Stan Lee and Jack Kirby were CIA. I mean, maybe they were, who knows, but it, but certainly it was just a much more grassroots level, and the products were much purer. And B, it's a comic book, so there's, you're creating your own environment, and I guess that makes it in a way more insidious because you're kind of participating in it, but anyway, very different from now, where you're actually just bombarded with this literalized imagery of the explosions and the death. I remember the last, pretty much the last one I saw, or one of the last, it was really terrible, was Man of Steel, and how violent that was. I mean, it hinted at, but it pulled back from actually showing that Superman was really a mass murderer, like just this great weapon of mass destruction. The amount of people that would have been killed in the battle he had with whoever it was, but buildings being destroyed, cars crushed, there would have been thousands of people killed just because he was, wanted to kick somebody's ass. And it was implicit in it, but it wasn't, because it's Superman, so they didn't actually acknowledge it. But really, it was just this orgy of destruction. So yeah, that, I mean, just the it's it really is. I mean, the glorification of violence is one thing that, of course, has been part of Hollywood since forever. Ku Klux Klan, Birth of a Nation, right? The first mainstream movie, but for it to then have this much more insidious thing of actually, traumatic violence will engineer you in a way that you will become super powerful slash enlightened, in quotes, like conflating violence with superpowers and then conflating superpowers with becoming fully embodied,
Well, it's just amazing to me, like, what a high percentage of the movies out there are just doing variations on a theme of this narrative. Like, think about those with this, like, the Bourne movies, and then all the superhero movies, and then you'd probably have to include probably a good, well, in this, the Star Wars movies or whatever, you'd probably have to include a good 33% of movie tickets sold as being sold to allegories of MK Ultra. What was there? The American Ultra was
I was
another.
gonna say they looked like they came clean with that one, yeah.
And then. And then I guess you'd have to also say that the vampire movies are kind of not too far off from this sort of thing.
Well, if because if there's an underlying theme to these, I mean, they were talking about self-empowerment fantasies, right? And the underlying theme of that. Or if that being the underlying theme and the how that correlates with trauma and dissociation, basically. I mean, if that's the primary mechanism that's being represented in the narratives is we get traumatized, we dissociate. We dissociate into this fantasy of being super powerful, one way or another.
Well, and I think about our the way our culture works, which has been founded or based on continually expanding for so long. And at this point, we can't really expand too much further because we've run up against the basic like limits of geography in terms of, you know, we could you know, start colonies on the moon or Mars or whatever, but and what we do is we just take nature and we turn it into heaps of junk, and the main value being the speed at which we can do this, right? And trying to figure out how can we go faster and turn more nature into more junk. And that the speed is key to this, and that what else is key to this is that it reinforces and maintains a hierarchy in some way.
Right, yeah. So, well, I mean, I was thinking about this recently about growth. Like, growth is only partially represented in nature. Like, there's no such thing as unchecked expansion in nature. It's a cyclical. Right? Things do grow, but then they fall off and they rot. That's the cycle, right? And human beings, we grow. Maybe, as in we mature anyway, we don't grow bigger after a certain point. But we might grow in terms of wisdom, ideally. We could certainly grow in terms of material status. But then we die. So then with human beings, there's a variation, right? Because nature, a fruit grows, it falls off the tree and it rots, but then the seeds, you know? So, bring about new trees. So there is that expansion over the generations. But with human beings, it's kind of, there's a variation, as in we, like the lineages, this whole thing of lineages. I mean, that just seems to be very key to talking about the hierarchy and maintaining the hierarchy. Because you can't keep growing as an individual. You're going to die. So then you want to be able to pass what you have on to the children to make so that the power stays in the hands of the lineage. But still, if we're talking about people who are trapped in these traumatized, constructed identities, what's in it for them if they get to pass it on to their children? It seems like there's a hidden factor there.
Do you think that it could be possible that there's a dissociated part of these people in these lineages that is inherited? You know, maybe that's the key to this monarchy thing, is maybe that there is an immortal fragment. Or, conversely, and probably more likely, a fragment that considers itself immortal. That somehow, like, believes itself to be the ancestor reincarnated, that somehow... you know, drive the members of these lineages or something.
That's what I was getting at. I was just reading Jung, this is a secret history of Jung, the Aryan Christ, which I just found out the author has some dodgy affiliations. But anyway, Jung's grandfather was called Carl Gustav Jung, and I was thinking, you know, why would people do that? Why would they name their son after their father right down to the middle name? And recently I talked to a survivor, who I won't name because she didn't do it for the podcast. We didn't record it or anything. I was rather disappointed by that. Anyway, she described her experiences with all of that, you know, that world, ritual abuse. And at one point she said that what they're doing through this ritual abuse is that they're moving energy, they're directing energy, and the goal, one of the goals is to, put the soul of a dead ancestor into the child that's being abused. So to use the children as vessels for for previous, you know, for ancestors. And I was also thinking about this earlier when you were talking about the how as kids we dress, we have no sense of self-consciousness about dress. Then we become teenagers and we're hip and we try and be cool, and then when we become parents, we revert in some way to this previous state. There was something around that, like, I mean, the obvious thing is when a person becomes a parent, they become square, which is a Masonic term, on the level, responsible, Saturnian, right? But then Saturn ate his own children, there's a thing about Saturn. And part of that, I mean, central to that is that we lose, I'm not a parent, but it is said, and it makes sense, that adults lose their edge when they have a children, when they have a child. That life force goes into the child. They become more responsible, but they're also kind of depleted in a way. They're also, they've given birth to their successor, right? They're already being supplanted. And have you read Castaneda, by the way?
No.
Okay. That'd be a really interesting conversation there if you had. But it doesn't matter because I was just going to cite something from Castaneda. He, in his fifth book, which was after this Don Juan had left and it seemed like the series was over, but then he kind of rebooted it and started a whole new sort of run of these memories he was having after. Anyway, he writes that in the sorcerer's world, they recognize that when a person has a child, they lose, the reason they lose their edge and become responsible is that a big portion of their energetic being goes into the creation of the child, and so they essentially have this hole in their energy field. And that in the sorcerer's world, if they want to attain freedom slash immortality, not the same thing, but anyway, they have to get that energy back. So in the sorcerer's world, the sorcerers who have children often end up killing their own children just to get that energy back. So that's very Saturn, right? That's
Yeah, I was thinking about I was reading about a friend of ours, a poet, who's I was sort of studying her family, and her I guess there was a line of eight of them that had the same name. And you know, the first one built this business empire, and you know, it was passed down through the generations. And you know, just the way that you know, that these fortunes are passed down. And I guess I had a feeling at one point, you know, sort of a mini psychosis or something like that, of incarnating my own grandfather. You know, that I had somehow was a continuation of him. You know, and I just wonder, like, you know, studying the Hohenzollern dynasty, that you know, they were the ones that ran Prussia
Oh,
and
right.
ended up with the Kaiser Wilhelm, but there's still some of them around, you know. But the way that they like transmitted, and this is a very traumatized dynasty, it's like you can read it, they're sort of like the ones that you see David Lynch's. Well, I guess any version of Dune, you know, the Harkonnens
Right.
are basically the Hohenzollerns.
Have you read Dune, by the way? Because it's I haven't read it, but my wife's been listening to the audiobooks, and she says it's MK Ultra,
Oh, it's the same
so
story.
yeah.
And there was a lot of it in science fiction in the 60s and the 50s. There was Man Plus by Frederick Pohl was one of my favorites when I was growing up. This was a guy who was like engineer to colonize Mars, and they basically flayed him alive and put a new skin on him, stuff like this. It was agonizing. And then he couldn't really, I think at one point he escapes, but then he finds out he has nothing in common with normal humans anymore, and so he decides he wants to go to Mars, and he's like miserable, and he thinks the whole thing has been a disaster. But then when he gets to Mars, all of a sudden he feels like a fish in water, and he's just pleased as can be. He starts bounding around the surface of Mars with glee.
Wow.
But I don't know, there is a certain, like, I guess, sense that when you have, I guess when people, like, you read somebody like Frederick the Great, the second Frederick, he's so miserable, and yet he, like, it's sort of his misery and his alienation that make him effective as a ruler, and you think about like this kind of the way that this sort of neurosis and psychosis that this kind of trauma causes creates these people who can't relate to either the people who haven't been traumatized, the sort of the people who have been fortunate enough to have been raised in whatever pockets of sanity are left, or the people who have been traumatized and who haven't awakened to it, who haven't, like, who are still playing that whatever role they've been assigned with a sort of earnest, fooling themselves into it,
You mean like Whitley, more like,
like the kind of, or you almost feel like L. Ron Hubbard is one of these. This is kind of like, or Robert Heinlein, that kind of like enthusiastic will to power. These people are unbearable, right? They're like, Kripal kind of reminds me of this. And these people like Whitley and Kripal, they seem to sort of thrive in a certain way. Like, they seem to be rewarded, for their role in propagating this whole thing. But of course, they do seem miserable on another level, and I don't wonder if they aren't, like, I don't know, I think a lot of these people have a lot of sicknesses, like a lot of physical illness.
Yeah, but I mean, doesn't everyone though? So,
see is a big old hole where I used to be. Gone. Everything's empty. Consciousness. A TV movie. We've got nothing on this. Feeling is empty. The mind's a void. The soul is empty. The world's a void. I want nothing.
Oh, and another version of this MK Ultra story, I guess, is Parsifal, right?
Is Parsifal traumatized?
Yeah, I think he's, well, in a weird way, because the first thing that he does, you know, when he goes out is he kills his father, and then he goes on the hunting party for the person who killed his father. Then he realizes it was him. You know, and that's his trauma, basically, is this, like, unbearable guilt.
So this is long before he comes to the castle and meets the Fisher King. And I think I picked up the story late in the game. I certainly don't know the opera and all that, but I know, you know, Wagner and the Nazis were all into it big time.
Yeah. Well, and the Nazis, of course, that version of Germany was an outgrowth of Prussia. You know, it was like the Hohenzollerns united Germany under their emperor, who was the Kaiser, right? And then that was destroyed at the end of World War I, but then when it was the Second Reich, right? And then the Third Reich, which was supposed to be the thousand-year Reich, ended up being like the 10-year Reich or 12-year Reich.
Yeah, unless you go with the blowback, MKUltra, CIA being the the forthright underground, right?
Right, and that's the whole thing, is that it's somehow like they sacrificed their commoners, you know, but somehow the essence of that, it was like reincarnated. Like this fragment of it was reincarnated here in the United States or in the New World Order or whatever, you know, as a sort of like, I mean, what's this stuff Winnie Hoffman is talking about with Joseph Mengele? I mean, what is that? Or what is the whole thing with the CIA being kind of, or NASA with Wernher von Braun and what's his name? Dorn? I forget his name. The guy who ran the one in Alabama. Well, Alabama was Wernher von Braun. The guy who ran the other one was Dorn. I can't remember. But then, like, Richard Gehlen, you know, or there in fact being this sort of Nazi eugenic skull and bones group, you know, was outgrowth of that Prussian secret society, you know. So the Bushes that had been funding the Nazis, then Bush running the CIA, and then the two Bushes as president, you know, this is like our Nazi heritage here.
So what led you to feel like you were possessed by a fragment of your grandfather?
It's hard to say. Like, it was this, I guess, this period when I was remembering all these traumas and then, like, reintegrating them. And this identity popped up, like this, and it was funny because I had almost forgotten about it.
Is it your paternal grandfather?
My maternal grand, my mother's father, and he was a Mason. He was a Shriner, which meant he was like a 33rd level Mason, and he worked on the Manhattan Project. He was a real alcoholic, and he had this small company that he ran that basically like was a contractor of AT&T and Bell Company. Subcontractor, and that was sort of put into being. He had been sort of unsuccessful. He was a very good engineer, but then he was couldn't make any money at that. He invented a like a butterfly valve and took all the money from it, and then he went into sales to try to make some money to feed his family, and then he instead got into the scheme with this guy who was like some kind of Masonic buddy who set up this company for him in Houston, where they did this contracting work for the phone company. And yeah, he was like about the age where I was becoming an individual, sort of. I guess around the time when I was 12 or 13 or something, he became like a zombie. He had like a heart attack and a stroke, and he sort of became this like semi-vegetative person. And so when I was like, a couple of years ago, when I was reincorporating a lot of this stuff that I was working through, I suddenly had the feeling that I was like a vessel for him. That I'd been sort of engineered to, and there was actually a novel that I'd written in which, in a sort of allegorical form, I wrote that up in a story.
You wrote this idea that you were a vessel for your grandfather.
But it was written differently. It was like, it was this story about how, like, the character who represented me, like, commits suicide by throwing himself into the ocean, and then when he washes up, he meets his grandfather on the beach, who like gives him a bag of jewels that like represents the family treasure, So that was all really weird.
It's reminding me of Contact, that Carl Sagan thing that made the movie out, because she finally meets, oh, I don't even remember, it must be the alien in the form of her dead father on the beach. And then that's reminding me of one of the things that Strieber has pushed quite hard in the last 10 years or whatever. I think his wife was mainly instrumental in reaching this conclusion, is that the visitors are intertwined with the dead. So his experiences with the visitors includes encounters with people he's known who have died, and so he considers that the visitors are involved somehow with our dead, which would be our ancestors.
Well, I think, like, if you take what we've been saying, or, from what I understand of what you've been saying, is that and I agree with, is that the psyche is what there is, you know, is that we're basically moving about and having our being within the greater psyche. And that the dead and the aliens and the little people, they all come from and return to the symbolic realm. You know, that's the sort of like the fixed sphere of the stars at the outer limit of the psyche, you know. What was it? Somebody said that the letters are formed of the bones of the ancestors.
The letters.
The letters of the alphabet.
Oh, no, I've not heard that before. Right, that's interesting, because language is compartmentalization of awareness, I guess. You could relate it to that, and that's fragmentation. Yeah. Compartmentalization seems to only happen through fragmentation. Right?
Yeah.
So we're having this conversation at a blog. We didn't go any further than a couple of comments, but it's definitely a rich area to go into about how the pentagram, somebody was saying the banishing ritual of the pentagram wasn't that to do with trying to disown parts of your psyche and prevent them from ever coming back, right? And then I pointed out how the pentagram itself could be seen as a fragmentation of the psyche, as in you've got the psyche as a circle or a sphere, and then your pentagram is chopping it up into these different compartments. So,
yeah, and that, I mean, the pentagram also is a sort of representation of the human body.
Right, and that Michael Angelo is saying, yeah.
And that fiveness, you know, with the hand or the head and the limbs. That there's this kind of, but I feel like, you know, they say language is what, in the left side of the brain?
Yeah.
And that idea of one part of the brain sort of banishing the other or sending the other one away, and that, you know, you read some of these people sometimes. I mean, I was reading this psychology text about dissociation. And you read some of these people, like there was this researcher who says that, you know, he's basically was trying to prove that people couldn't have a fragmented psyche or something like that.
Right.
And his writing was so... it was like very logical, and everything was very clear cut. It was like, and I felt like he was a moron. You know, I felt like he was almost retarded. Mm. Like the way that this person was writing, you could tell that he just had no sense of nuance or of subtlety. And then there was another essay in the same book that was by a woman who was talking about the fragmentation of the psyche, and she wrote poetically. She had this sort of humanity and this sensitivity and this compassion for the people that she was talking about. And it was just like, yeah, okay, so I think that when you say that language is about or relies on fragmentation or causes fragmentation, you see that in extreme cases, especially, that there are some people who are so literal and so rational that you can see that there's something retarded about them, like that there's something disfigured about their mind.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, and they say things like, and sometimes very intelligent writers, you know, who are well reviewed in the New York Times, will say these things like that we cannot think without language. You know, and so it struck me as being like absurd, because I can think with images. I can think musically, you know? And I'm perfectly capable of thinking in terms of somatic sensations.
Right.
You know?
So that's consciousness.
Right? Yeah. So. That there's, that like, I don't, and yet you read somebody say something like that, and the only way I can understand that is that they're saying that they can only think in language.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that they're somehow, that they're so broken that the only part of themselves that they recognize is this storytelling part.
Right.
Or this part that...
Narrating, that, yeah.
Yeah, and I believe that that's what those people actually think, and that those people are probably... their readers probably also agree with this.
Well, it's the narrative that reinforces itself, isn't it? Because the narrative is saying all there is narrative. That's the narrative. So,
yeah.
We were talking about ratio on the last podcast, but one I think was the Noor, and about the correct ratio of the senses. So, I mean, there's more than five, but we've reduced it to five. That's another form of, you know, rationing, which is distorting the reality. But anyway, just for so convenience.
Huh? Right?
What?
Maybe that's your pentagram there too, right?
The five senses, yeah. Right.
But go ahead, sorry.
Yeah. So, yeah, the correct ratio between the, actually, we were talking about in terms of the four main senses, and the correct ratio is the fifth sense, or the unified sense of tactility, because all the other senses are tactile in a sense. Even with our eyes, we touch, and hearing is sound waves are touching us, etc. So it's all tactility. But anyway, the correct ratio is when they're all unified into a single synesthetic sense, and that would be rationality and ratioing used in order to unify. So you have the correct ratio so that things can combine together into a single perceptual experience. But on the other hand, the power to ration and compartmentalize can prevent that from happening also. If you just keep rationing and you keep rationalizing, then you can you emphasize in a way that is incorrect, etc., and so you actually prevent any kind of unification from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then you end up with a narrative about how everything is narrative, or a thought that says everything is thinking, or an ancestral fragment that says I am the ancestor and I am you, kind of that this fragment that actually believes it's the whole and then can possess a body and convince or create a reality in which that appears to be the whole experience. So it seems as though there's, in all of these cases, maybe including the pentagram, the banishing ritual, it's like a way of staving off integration, because integration is perceived as annihilation, like to be absorbed into the whole, even when the whole is your soul, your psyche, it's actually who you are. That feels like it's annihilating.
Mm-hmm.
So then if you resist that in life, constructed identity, resist death, because that's also the danger of annihilation, how can it escape death? It's got to reincarnate. It's got to somehow find a new body. Maybe all of this is kind of a metaphorical, or it's represented by the lineages that are all about hierarchies, maintaining position of power, accruing wealth, passing on the wealth to the following generations, passing on the drives and the goals. And I wonder too, when you say about your grandfather, like, because I seem to be getting closer and closer to talking about this, how the constructed identity can survive death, how that seems to relate to ancestral patterns, and how they possess us and direct us. Yeah, so I've wondered that. I've started to wonder that too, like how much have I been possessed by these ancestral fragments? And what does that mean? You know, how do you...
An old age, no end to old age. No way. All I have is my magic song. 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 No need to feel ashamed. Nothing to lose, nothing to gain. There's no fear anymore. Fear never really was there before, and it's gone.
Like, I feel that when you talk about the 1% or the cultural elites, the upper classes, that these are people who are very aware of their past. You know, they have probably portraits of their ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
They have, maybe their ancestors are even famous, and they have places named after them. You know, they can easily trace, they probably have a ancient family Bible in their house that has many generations of the family tree in them. And then if you go to the opposite extreme, here in the United States at least, like poor people, they don't know who their great grandparents are.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of them have no idea where, like, and this is really I mean, you know, people go on Ancestry.com or whatever, and they have these ways that, you know, genealogy can be done. But by and large, like, I would say, you know, the vast majority of people have actually been denuded of their past. Like, there's been this this sort of effort to dislocate people from whatever communities they come from, and to, you know, to strip them of whatever inherited objects or inherited customs they might have, You know, people have been stripped of their food ways. You know, they've been taken away from where they came from. There's been this real drive through mass culture to change people's ways of child rearing, of, you know, definitely through technology, the ways of transmission of culture and the ways of making culture have been changed. So that, on the one hand, you have this, you probably do have these, ancestral inheritance that's determining what a lot of people are doing and thinking and the way that they're acting, but they're also on the logos level or the, you know, the narrative level completely ignorant of that. You know, so does that make that more powerful? Does that make that more unconscious and therefore more determining?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas perhaps, you know, people who have some sort of consciousness of their genetic past and maybe better able to integrate those.
Yeah, well, it's logical, isn't it? Because if you find out your grandfather had a passion for chocolate or whatever, then you realize that you, what you took to be your own predilection is actually can be traced back, then you begin to question, how much is this actually authentically who I am, and how much of it is a passed on trait, assuming, of course, there's a difference.
Well, I was always thinking about, you know, the question of, sexual preference, is it genetic or is it learned?
Yeah.
You know, I was wondering about, you know, there's, I read a little bit about the history of sexuality, and I've always wondered if one of the functions of secret societies or the Masonic groups or whatever was in periods where, sodomy was illegal, if the purpose of secret societies like that wasn't to a large extent to create a context in which people could, you know, be homosexual or be, and that's something that I think could, you know, be positive. Or on the other hand, if it's a traditional of pedophilia, it's more of a negative thing. Like, here's a structure that could protect, this taboo sexuality as well.
So that's back to that liminal space of not necessarily role-playing, but there seems to be an overlap there between a space in which there are no rules and you can improvise and role-play, and a space in which you can do real stuff that you're not allowed to do in ordinary society. You're still creating a kind of fantasy realm in the sense that it's outside of the consensus. It seems as though our sexuality is the most fundamental thing about us in terms of what we're talking about here, in terms of ancestry and genealogy and passing on traits. That's basically it. That's the way that it happens, right? So then it stands to reason that the psychological traits that we pass on would get passed on most, that the imprints would be deepest when they relate, when they're sexually, you know, configured, like psychosexual qualities. So,
and I wonder if there's other times in history when I don't know, just in our time period, this one thing that children and adults don't talk to each other about.
Mm-hmm.
It's like children have to learn about sex from their peers. If there is a conversation between adults and children about sex, it's just like this very awkward thing. It's like almost this famously awkward thing for both parties, you know?
Yeah.
And how is that engineered, or is that natural? Is there some sort of, built into the biology, some sort of blindness to sexuality between generations? so that every generation like seems like it thinks it invented sex.
Well, isn't it inseparable from the element of shame? I mean, isn't that the element that has prevented the clear transmission of knowledge around sex, is the element of shame. So,
yeah, and is it shame culturally transmitted, or is it like innate in some way?
Well, it's in the Bible, right?
You see, because I always thought it was culturally transmitted,
yeah.
But then like you see, for example, dogs, like the way they look when they're pooping.
I wonder though. I mean, is it only domestic dogs, or is it like wild dogs? Well, we wouldn't see wild dogs, but even street dogs, for example, do they? That would be an interesting study, right?
Yeah.
Because I have a feeling that dogs, they imitate. We're all imitative, and dogs tend to imitate humans because they actually, if they're owned by humans or taken care of by humans, then they think of humans as they're kind of aspiring to that level, and they. And so they may imitate feelings that they see in humans. It could even be just mirroring, like whenever you're looking at a dog, you feel embarrassed for the dog, and then it's actually mirroring it back at you right in that moment.
That's true.
So, of course, that's a different thing. Like, shitting isn't, despite the proximity of the different parts of the body, you know, the excretory, organs from the with the genitals. Despite that, they're not actually synonymous, right?
So, and we have this friend now who has this dog who just is constantly humping everybody's leg.
Yeah, and he's not embarrassed.
No shame whatsoever. No. That it's like as many times as he can be told no.
Yeah.
And, you know, even like you know, scolded.
Yeah. No,
never is there, you know, you never a trace of shame.
It makes more sense for there to be shame, quote unquote, or awareness around shitting than sex, like, because shitting literally is dirty. I mean, that is something that you want to do. You don't want it to be in people's way, because then you're going to get into shit, so to speak.
Yeah.
That's going to cause a problem if you shit.
Oh, but then one thing they were pointing out was is that the idea that for the dog that it's a kind of a dominance thing, like that he. And I think that this is an aspect of sexuality that goes in with like you know, DeMoss was talking about with the soldiers.
Mm.
You know, you castrate and anally rape the defeated soldiers.
Yeah.
And then also, like, I feel like in, like, Texas football, for example, they're always having these hazing scandals where they're shoving, like, pine cones up some poor kid's butt and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, like, there's this element of sexual violence, male-on-male sexual violence that's, like, really deep in all these secret societies as well, I think. And I think it's the way that the hierarchies work at oil companies is that it has nothing to do because you see, like, they have all these technicians working for them, scientists, engineers, and stuff like that, but the managers and the plant managers are all hired from football teams. They're like the kids who are on college football, and so it's very strange, you know what I mean? It's like in the corporate world, like they've done studies on this or something where they show that the biggest predictor of economic success in the United States is success in sports, and this and the way that these sports. And the fraternities work to a large degree is through this kind of power-based sodomizing. And so the only person in those situations that feels ashamed is the person on the bottom, like the person who is sodomized is ashamed, and they're like taught to you know, like, to not speak of this. Did you ever hear the thing about Columbine? Like, one of the kids in Columbine apparently had been sodomized by a police officer.
Mm-mm.
And he was, and the jocks at his school, the football players, had found out.
Mm.
Apparently the cops had told them, look, we sodomized that guy because these football players were throwing bloody tampons at him. It was like a form of taunting him.
Well, that's like the beginning of Carrie.
Yeah, and so it's like, suddenly, like, Columbine then makes a lot more sense, right? But they didn't talk about that part.
Right,
and all the news coverage that the real story is that, like, police were systematically raping boys in the area.
Wow. No, I hadn't heard that at all. Huh. There's somebody, the next podcast actually is this woman, Robin Eubanks, who is a lawyer, and she's researching the Common Core education, tracing it back to Fabian Society and probably the Prussian schooling. And anyway, that whole can of worms around that, but she, very interesting, and she's also discovered that the school shootings globally really tend to occur in schools where these kind of education methods have particularly have been amped up.
What kind of educational methods? You said co-education?
Common Core is the name for it now, right? But it's too big a ball of wax, but I've kind of explored it a bit with Occult Yorkshire and Fabian schooling, progressive schooling and whatnot. Yeah, but anyway, that was kind of a side thing about the school shooting. But I was thinking that the shame thing, the sexual shame, how that relates to, like, if you sabotage someone's sexuality, if you hijack it in such a way that the shame, that they can't own it, they can't feel comfortable with themselves sexually, then they can't feel comfortable in their bodies, and then that would seem to be a way to hijack autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
A person can't be fully autonomous if they can't actually just be in their body. And then, so in terms of a control system and a hierarchy, it does seem pretty obvious when we look at it in this way. Right? Just how do you implement that, and how do you maintain it? Well, you know, hijack the sexuality at the earliest possible opportunity, so sex and shame will be forever conflated. So, and that, I mean, that's in the original text, right? In Genesis, that's actually the children committing a sin, being told that this is a sin, while at the same time being lured into committing it, and then being exposed by the father and being banished. That would be the original trauma narrative.
Well, and I think that there's something, I mean, that whole, like, the whole Old Testament is cobbled together appropriation. Like, there's basically, there was like that sort of area of the Middle East. The Amorites had a bunch of sort of indigenous creation myths that I think that was a part of. And then, you know, when the human sacrifice cults sort of hijacked the, you know, the local population, that they incorporated that, but they worked it into their own narrative.
Who's they? The Hebrews?
Well, what was it? This guy, Redford, calls it the Hyksos. There were, but whether you talk about them or just like the the Baal worshippers, you know, in Babylon or whatever.
Mm.
You have these groups that are doing this kind of human sacrifice, and that, like, clearly, like, monotheism doesn't make any sense on just, like, on any level, because there's this, like, basically the most that you can say for it is that it's a redefinition of the word God, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're saying, before monotheism, well, in the older strata of the Old Testament, you have the Elohim, which is a feminine plural,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you have these different words, like you have these different superhuman beings, you know, you have the giants, the Nephilim, you have the serpent, you have El, you have Elohim, you have a Shaddai, you know, you have these different beings that are superhuman, angels, and then you have this, apparently this one being at this one point in Exodus who then says, I am the only God.
Yeah.
You know, which is patently untrue in light of everything that's come up to that point, right?
Mm.
And so the only way that you can really read that is that one of them has usurped the narrative.
Right.
Yeah. and the least savory one of the bunch, undoubtedly.
Mm.
You know, and so basically, like, you have to see all monotheism as being devil worship. You know, that it's the unsavory...
worshipping the fragment.
Yeah, the one that wants to eat burned flesh.
So that's back to the language as well, like the inception of religion, being congruent with the inception of language and the Hebrew alphabet and the I. Like, as soon as you have a line, a sentence, you need a subject and an object, and so you need an I am becomes necessary.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because that's, I guess that's what the monotheist is, right? It's the ego. It's saying that I am the only one.
Yeah.
Is this fragment is usurping the entire universe.
Yeah, and it demands worship,
mm-hmm.
which is a contradiction, really. I mean, the whole thing is contradictory. I guess that's part of what you're saying about why monotheism doesn't add up, because you can't have a one without another, right? So, and if the I am that I am demands worship, then how supreme can he be, right? Actually, without other fragments to worship, the one fragment that says it's me, I'm the one, nothing's happened. You've just got one fragment saying I'm the one, and then another one can say no, it's me, right? But if that fragment can persuade all the others, then you've got something, and you've got a hierarchy.
Yeah, and I think it only works in the context of sacrifice, you know.
Well, that's very Girard, because he's saying that the violence and the sacred and the inception of culture and religion began with the sacrifice and with the lie that the sacrifice was not a murder, but a sacred act. So that's kind of that's that murdering narrative that makes itself the hero.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, Parsifal.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Parsifal commits the act of murder, and then he says, "I'm going to hunt down the killer."
Yeah, and that's the logic that comes is behind all the hierarchy, you know.
Because
we're the righteous because we're the ones who kill.
Right, and we maintain order because there are killers out there.
Yeah,
it's a protection racket.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere today, not today, but a couple days ago, that 52% of the Democrats in the United States approved of the use of torture.
when they were
you
up.
Know, about, you know, the Republicans, it was something like 70 or 80%, you know, but I always thought the Democrats, you know, that 50, more than half of this, you know, call themselves, you know, this supposedly liberal party are down with torture.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Like, that's how long, I mean, how well they've been worked on.
Yeah.
And tortured themselves, really, right? In subtle ways, if not literal.
And it points to these odds, you know, long odds for anything positive to come out of this country.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold out your hopes for that. No. Yeah, so I think that's an understatement, really. What's that saying? Nothing good comes out of Jerusalem? Just Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world come tumbling down. Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your prayer. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his world came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey. His mind. Now here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Now here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his world came tumbling.